Good morning. Once it was Armistice Day, marking the end of World War I on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. On this Veterans Day, we hear a national history project to save veteran stories and of a plan to save the Honolulu Memorial for the war and make the natatorium pool functional. Plus, the opinion of one veteran on mandatory service. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoop. Classical guitarist Andrew York has performed in more than 30 countries. He's in Hawaii for a UH performance, and he's with us in our studio. And a life in America would be the fulfillment of a dream for people all over the world. People like Toto, the protagonist of a new film from the Philippines, from director John Paul Su. He's with us in our studio.
It's Veterans Day, November 11th. The conversation starts after the news. Welcome to the conversation on this Veterans Day.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning, Chris.
This is a day when we'll hear many expressions of appreciation of America's veterans, and some of those expressions might make you wonder what was happening the other 364 days.
A lot of people, feel that we've just so lost touch with that because we've had such, so many families who do not have a family member in the service, that once upon a time that was not the case. Now it is. And so approaching veterans and approaching military families as others seems to be more the norm.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that a little bit because, as we just said, a few generations ago, it was not uncommon for most families to have a family member in the military. These days, not so much. And that divide between military servicemen and women and civilians seems to have grown wider, with very little understanding of either beyond the headlines. That could change, according to one veteran. Vic Kraft recently co-wrote an editorial in support of mandatory service in the military, or that could even be Peace Corps of the Vista, some other type of organization to engage young people in the business of doing and not so much talking. Vic Kraft is a retired Air Force veteran. He joins us now. Good morning, Vic. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Beth Ann.
What made you want to do this? I mean, we've talked about veterans for a very long time. You have been a veteran for a very long time now. But what made you turn your attention to this idea of universal service?
I've seen it work in other countries where it becomes not necessarily a homogenizing factor, but it forces people to work with one another. And that's one of the things that the armed forces and also any other kind of volunteer service, such as VISTA or Peace Corps, it brings people from all walks of life, from all ethnic backgrounds, whatever variable you want to throw in there. And these people now have to work with one another. And you gain a certain respect for people, and you now understand their motivations, and you work with those people, and you work with those motivations and respect those things. I think we've kind of lost that. Everybody's out for themselves right now. Now, they're more concerned with what's in it for them as opposed to what can they do for the country.
The sense of self-sacrifice and giving to other people and finding out who you are in doing that seems to be something that some schools bring in terms of, community service. And many schools have a community service requirement for graduation. A lot of kids look at that and it's like one more thing they have to do. Sometimes it turns them on to what service means. Other times it's just, let's get through this and graduate, and that's sort of the end of it. Some people go into doing a lot of community and volunteer work. A lot of people do not. What I'm hearing you say is that there would be a leveling bar if everyone had to give a year to some form of service and learn to understand each other a little better through that process.
I worked with the Swiss Armed Forces many years ago. And I thought it was very interesting that from the time you're 18 years old, you have a couple of years in which to show up in front of your draft board. You now have to serve at minimum 18 months of active duty service. Most of that's in training, but you go home, You're now on the hook for 20 years in the armed forces. You are now a member of the armed forces for 20 years, even though it's in a reserve status or what they call the National Guard. It's a very interesting system, and you look at that country and see how well it works, particularly from a political standpoint. People are engaged in the political process, and it seems, well, of course, Switzerland hasn't declared war on anybody in a long time.
So it makes it a little easier maybe in Switzerland. But if you're talking about countries like Israel, maybe even, you know, some of the Norway, other countries where there could be engagement.
Sure. But then again, how quickly can you gather an army when it's necessary? In the United States, we have a population of 330 million people or thereabouts. Veterans represent right now at best 6% of that. We don't have a voice, and I think that people would have a better understanding of what it is to give of themselves if they did do some kind of service.
This goes into an even deeper conversation about character.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that for many families who had anyone involved with World War II and what Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation,
correct,
that's become the benchmark. And few of us have been able to rise to that level because we didn't have some of those experiences that made us rise to that level. And
exactly,
what I hear you saying is that we need something that begins to force that conversation a little bit more.
Curiously, you go around now and look at neighborhoods. How many stars do you see in windows? That used to be an indication of I had a member of the family in the armed forces, and a gold star was they lost a member of that family. What kind of sympathy or empathy does the public have right now towards those people that are serving in Afghanistan and Iraq and around the world? It seems that, okay, great. It's sort of like seeing the yellow bumper stickers or the red, white, and blue bumper stickers. I support our troops. How? It may be that, yes, you support them, but how does that translate into reality or to something substantive?
Right, feeling to action.
Exactly. It's great to see those types of people. I'm not condemning them for doing that, but and there may be some people out there that are doing volunteer work. I belong to a veterans group out in West Oahu. We get involved in a lot of different things as far as the community, not just related to veterans issues either.
But your point is that we don't have much opportunity to engage with veterans and to engage with the military. Sometimes we even, you know, regard our own military in Hawaii as sort of, you know, the hidden population, that there's not a lot of cross-pollination.
No, and the United States has a history of that. It's very distrustful of its armed forces. You look at every war that it's engaged in immediately after the war, get rid of the troops, forget about it, we didn't have a war. I look at the bonus march. I look at why did we come up with the cliche of red tape? That came from the Civil War, from their veterans.
So just to bring this home, is there any movement afoot to be able to create any sort of mandatory service, or is this still in the conversational stage?
Curiously, we have yet to get any pushback on the editorial. There were other people that gave it a thumbs up in private conversation. Yes, we've had people support it. But in terms of any organization stepping up or any politician stepping up, no.
Well, we'll see if any of this changes in future. A lot of uncertainty that we're looking at now.
Oh, absolutely.
Vic Kraft, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Vic Kraft enlisted in the Air Force in the 60s and was trained as an aircraft mechanic. He saw tours in Vietnam, the United Kingdom, and Kenya. After leaving active duty, he pursued a 45-year career in aerospace, working in program management and quality assurance on several major weapon systems. He's now retired. The editorial he co-wrote in support of mandatory national service is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Hawaii Pacific University and Ulupono Initiative.
And this is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It is 8:13, and coming up in the show, a live classical guitar performance from virtuoso Andrew York. But first, your quiz.
Today's Backyard Quiz honors our nation's veterans, for whom November 11th has been designated a national holiday. The date was selected to coincide with the anniversary of the ceasefire that ended fighting in World War I, hence its original name, Armistice Day. In 1954, November 11th was renamed Veterans Day to honor the living service members who fought in all wars. In Hawaii, Veterans Day is especially significant because the Aloha State is home to one of the highest populations of veterans and active duty service members in the country. It's fitting, then, that Hawaii is home to one of the Department of Veteran Affairs' national cemeteries, which is not an honor afforded all U.S. states. For today's quiz, what's the name and location of Hawaii's National Veteran Cemetery? Bet you've got this one. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the HPR prize.
The term classical guitar, if it's used to describe music that's a century old or more, has become a bit of a misnomer. The sound of the acoustic nylon string instrument transcends any historical period and still lends itself to new heights of invention for the performer and the composer. Andrew York is both a virtuoso instrumentalist who's written new works of his own, works he'll be performing at UH Manoa this Sunday, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. Hi, Chris. Good to be here.
As a classical guitarist, you don't want to just be the curator of a museum of old compositions, do you?
Well, as much as I admire, of course, old music, because it's still around, because it's great, and I still play Bach, things like that, but that doesn't suit my personality. I like to create new things. So I've dedicated my career and life to creating new music, and I have quite a catalog of modern guitar compositions that I perform.
And, of course, the instrument is wonderfully suited to any number of types of expression yet to be explored, right?
That's right. I think the most colorful instrument we have.
The ability of the guitar to provide nuance to individual notes and chords, it has a lot to do with your ability to sort of push the strings one way or the other across the neck, right? Things you couldn't do on a piano.
Well, yeah, that's it. I mean, as a guitarist yourself, you know, in a sense, this is the most primitive instrument there is. It's the only one you can think of where both hands, both sets of fingers are in contact with the vibrating medium. No other instruments like that. Piano is very insulated. It's a machine, a wonderful one. But guitar, we're literally touching and creating the pitch with the left hand and touching the vibrating strings with the right hand and plucking. Very, very primitive in a great way. It gives you a lot of nuance, like you said.
The feeling that comes back from having the strings vibrating beneath your hands is what keeps you going, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the reward, I always think.
It's very intimate and very tactile, yeah.
You brought a composition into play this morning, and I want to make sure we have time to play it. What is it that you were going to play?
This was an improvisation that I did, and my wife fortunately recorded it on her iPhone. It's called Home, and it sounds more like a Scottish folk song.
It's got that beautifully simple melody, doesn't it?
Very simple, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's hear it.
Okay. Thank you.
Beautiful piece, Andrew. And it originated as an improvisation. And, you know, the thing that happens in most improvisations is you lose the thread of your original idea, right?
Right, yeah.
I love that you stuck with that beautiful melody and just made it work in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thanks,
Andrew
Chris.
York will perform Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m. at UH Manoa's Orvis Auditorium. And you can find out more about him and his music on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hawaii Public Radio gratefully acknowledges Gil Roots of Hilo, Michelle Stevenson of Kamoela, and Christy Aragon of Kailua Kona for their recent membership gifts. And thank you to all of our listeners for your support. If you've yet to join HPR, you can become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting Los Angeles artist Karen Hampton's gallery talk on her textile exhibition, The Journey North, November 10th at 10 a.m. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Two days, two drownings on Kauai. Those deaths brought the island's annual drowning toll to double the number of all last year. With an ocean safety reality check, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
I mean, this is deeply disturbing to think that the toll has doubled there. And the question is, you know, why?
Well, you know, as you know, our Nathan Eagle wrote a whole series called Dying for Vacation. And the bottom line is, you know, people love to come to Hawaii, but a whole lot of them die here, very high numbers, and drowning is the number one cause. There's a number of reasons, but certainly one is they're just not aware of how dangerous it is. They see Hawaii as a paradise, and they think it's going to be safe, but in fact, our shorelines can be quite treacherous. And so here we have lost a 70-year-old woman from Kansas and a 73-year-old man from California. They died at Poipu Beach and Larson's Beach. And, you know, just last night, there was a near drowning on Waikiki. So this, once again, underscores how important it is that the tourism business, the county, and the state get out better warnings to our visitors about how dangerous it can be here.
We've had that conversation ongoing for such a long time because, you know, whether it's a huge toll or greater toll than we've seen in the year previous or whenever, a death is a death. And if it could have been prevented by better, you know, warnings, better understanding that as beautiful as the beach may look, it is treacherous. That doesn't seem to be happening as much. Is there any movement now?
Yeah, and I'll just put a spin on a few positive developments. There is a working group that is meeting regularly to try and address this. Our series got a lot of attention, including in the visitor industry, and people have been reading that. We could certainly use more lifeguards, particularly in remote beaches that we didn't normally staff, and that is something people are thinking about. But you might have to take it a step further, and as has been suggested, why don't you show a safety video on the airplane? I mean, you can't do anything else. You're sitting there for 5 hours. Why not show a video, short video, about how dangerous it can be here? And that way, visitors before they arrive are aware of just how serious it can be. It's not just drowning, by the way. It's also hiking and any number of activities.
A lot of things that we've talked about in past, but just getting them to have a reality check of their own before they land on our shores. Thank you so much.
Exactly.
And we'll talk to you on Monday.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. And it's a Friday, and even though it's a holiday, we're still going to take a look at what's coming out of our newsroom come next week. And to help us do that, News Director Bill Dorman is here. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You know, a lot of people would say around this time that there's we've pretty much had a lot of politics lately, and maybe it's enough of politics. But politics in a different way, really, next week, because we haven't, with all the focus on the national story, there are some threads on the local side of this, and in particular, the Republican Party in Hawaii. Now, of course, the lone Senate seat, of course, that they had is gone. But now, where does this go? Where does the local Republican Party go? The reflecting in part this national split on Trump and sort of reforming and all of that. So Wayne Yoshioka is going to take a look at where that stands, where the future is, who some of the players may be in terms of where that goes. And meanwhile, the business of government goes on. So city council meeting next week, number of topics they have on Oahu, the number of topics, one, some interesting discussions about the police. As you know, HPD mapping crimes, as within many places around the country. But in the HPD case, haven't been really tracking violent crimes in the same way. That's upset a lot of people at the neighborhood level. It's going to be reflected in a discussion at city council, and we'll see where that goes.
All right. Now, with all that going on and clearly heavy-weighted subjects, what happens for us next week is also a pretty important thing, marking Hawaii Public Radio's 35th anniversary, and there are also some other anniversaries happening around town.
It is true. 35 years of Hawaii Public Radio, and we'll have a couple of days on the air talking about that, and 15 years for a friend of ours in the nonprofit community in downtown here in Honolulu, Arts at Mark's Garage. Noe Tanigao is going to take a look ahead at what they are planning. They have an event at the end of the week on Friday, but also looking at some of what it is that Arts at Mark's brings to the community, brings to the neighborhood, and really is part of. And again, as with a lot of nonprofit institutions, you can't take these things for granted.
No, and a lot of people really do credit Mark's with being able to create a center, not just a cultural center, but restaurants, other things that began to happen around there, despite the fact that Hawaii Theater has been there for years. But it's just brought a whole different complement to.
And as a lot of downtown Honolulu tries to move to the next level, Arts at Mark's is a key part of that in the future,
right,
as well.
Definitely linchpin. Thank you so much for the preview.
You bet.
Bill Dorman joins us every Friday with a preview of what's coming out of our news department, and that'll all happen come Monday. When we talk about veterans in Hawaii, it has a particular meaning here. As we move further away from what happened at Pearl Harbor and America's entrance into World War II, the further away slips the proportion of families who had firsthand experience with a military family member and possibly one who came home. Those who did return came with stories, and like veterans of all wars and conflicts, they needed a place to rest. The Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress American Folklife Center is such a place. It began in 2000, and retired Army Colonel Karen Lloyd is its director. We talked earlier, and I asked her how these stories are moving through our culture in a way that might reacquaint someone with what a veteran has experienced.
Well, I'm glad you asked the question that way, because there's a couple things that really resonate with me, and one would be the Hacksaw Ridge movie that's recently out that talks about Desmond Doss, the first Congressional Medal of Honor winner who was a conscientious objector. And without his story, they never could have made the movie. And there's also some documentaries that are coming out from the A&E networks. And while we don't have any affiliation with either of those, the A&E network is coming down and donating 24 full interviews that are part of their documentary, which is going to air the first weekend in December. And so we're really excited about that. What I've discovered that this program can do is it can link relatives, with kids and grandkids, to better understand what their parents and their grandparents experienced, what they saw, what they did, and what it felt like to be in uniform. Yesterday, we had a Native American from Oklahoma in. He works at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and he served with the Special Forces in Vietnam. And he was able to talk about these stories that he had, and he said he felt like they were locked away. And by having these questions and somebody really listening to his answers and probing, that it enabled him to release these memories. And he said he had thought about people and places and events that he hadn't thought of in many, many years, and was happy at the end that he had taken the time to do it, and that he was then going to talk to his friends and encourage them to do it as well.
Karen, when we talk to veterans who have come out of different wars, the way we seem to approach them and the way we regard them has a lot to do with what happened in those conflicts or what happened in those wars. How have these stories been able to help create some more reality for the rest of us who have been feeling the impact of, you know, cultural ideals toward those wars or those conflicts?
Well, we would encourage your listeners to go up on our website. One-third of the collections that we have are digitized, so anybody can go up, loc.gov /vets with an S, and look at these stories. What I'm enjoying most about my current job is the ability to go in and read about these stories, and the detail of them is simply amazing, and they draw you in. For example, there's a lady, Alice Dixon. She was with the only all-female African-American postal unit in Europe, and that seems like a long way from Hawaii, but what was so fun about her story, or what she chose to share, is the fact that she was in charge of packages, and she had to figure out which soldiers had been deceased so that she could return those packages, and which of those packages she had to forward. And she shares how she found a bottle of whiskey. And she said, I couldn't send it forward to the line, so I couldn't return it. What was I going to do with it? So she took it to her captain and gave it to her, and the captain said, I'll take care of that. And then she went back to the barracks and was telling her bunkmates what she'd done, and they all said, you fool, you fool. Next time you find a bottle of whiskey in those packages, you bring it to us and we'll take care of it.
In general, as we as a culture are trying to look at how we now regard veterans in a time where we are very disconnected from the era in which almost every family had someone as a family member who was attached to the military, what does that say to you as you now talk to veterans and you also have access to these stories from very long ago?
What I'm discovering is that there's a connection between the life you live as a veteran and what you choose to share and the life of civilians who feel like they have no connection. The Pew Institute said that did research and 62% of every American has a relative who's a veteran. And I would suggest to you that if you start including friends, you will find that number goes up dramatically. And one of the things that we can do for our veterans from all the wars is take time to thank them for their service. But one of the ways to thank them is to ask them to talk about it. What was it like? And we would encourage you to arrange, think over the Veterans Day holiday, who are the veterans in my life, be they relatives or just friends and family, and then arrange so that you can have that conversation between now and Thanksgiving so that they understand the gratitude that you have for their selfless service. And you can then learn more about, you know, what they said, what they saw, what they did while they were in uniform. And I think you'd be really amazed at the stories that you hear, and you start to learn a whole other side to a lot of folks. You mentioned, you know, in Vietnam, we did a terrible job of welcoming our veterans home. And that was one of the things that the Native American George Bearpaw talked about yesterday in his. He said, I threw away my medals and all of anything that had to do with military because of the way I was received when I I returned home. And he said the only way I was able to get them back was through the Veterans Affairs. When I then said, here's what I've done and I made a terrible mistake, they sent him a whole new set. And so it's one of the ways that we can show gratitude and really thank the veterans whose selfless service allow us to have the freedoms that we have.
We talk about how veterans now come back into society. Many of them are dealing with physical pain. Some of them are dealing with mental anxiety, PTSD, so many ramifications of what they've experienced. How do we begin to approach them as we begin to understand some of these consequences of war in ways that weren't discussed way back when, weren't discussed even, 10 years ago?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. They haven't been discussed. And I'm not a psychiatrist, but it's certainly been my experience that if you take the time to talk with someone and really listen, somehow that seems to have a soothing effect on them. And what I've discovered is they tell you these amazing things. And they're thankful that you took the time to listen to what they had to say.
Well, we're very much appreciative of the time that you gave us this morning. And happy Veterans Day.
Well, thank you so much, and I appreciate that. And please thank all the veterans in Hawaii.
Retired Army Colonel Karen Lloyd is the director of the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. The congressionally mandated project collects, preserves the personal accounts of American war veterans, and you have access to them, too. You can see our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more information about how to hear those stories. Now, on Honolulu's Gold Coast, the memorial remembering those who served in World War I has been crumbling for decades. And for just as long, there's been a controversy over whether to save or demolish the natatorium. The National Trust for Historic Preservation recently offered a plan to the city. I talked with Senior Field Officer Brian Turner and how it seems to address the needs of all who want to see some or all of the natatorium preserved.
Well, the city is in the process of doing an EIS to determine the future of the site. And one of the things that they need to do as part of that is to look at alternatives that can achieve different objectives. Having a national profile on this has been great because we've been approached by some of the foremost engineers in ocean and structural design, and they volunteered their time to help us think through some of these issues.
Specifically, you have created a plan that allows the pool in part to remain, but not as a completely enclosed pool. What does that design look like, and how does it address the issue of bacteria and safety?
So the foremost component of this design is the breaking down of the seawall that's prevented wave energy from the ocean from getting in and mixing with the natatorium's waters. What Dr. Kroc is proposing to do here is to replace that seawall that's the barrier to entry for ocean waves with a series of chevron units, basically small concrete structures that would allow ocean water to filter through, and then go out through a gravity-fed system on both seawall sides and then come out on the Mackay side. What this means is that ocean energy will really be flushing out that swim basin almost constantly. But it'll also be enough to dissipate the wave action so swimmers are in a more protected area, like they are at Kohio Beach, for example, and make sure that that wave action doesn't act upon the stadium. So it allows that stadium to stay intact.
You mentioned Dr. Kroc. You mean Dr. Hans Kroc, the Emeritus Professor of Ocean and Resources Engineering at UH Manoa. Also, he was working with, Dr. Alfred Yee?
That's right. And Dr. Yee has the distinguished title of having worked on the USS Arizona Memorial in the 1950s and early 60s. So he has a long, reputable career in concrete structures and marine environments.
Do you have any sort of back-of-the-envelope cost on this relative to what we've heard before?
We don't know that, and that's why we're encouraging the city to look at this further. We want to do this in cooperation with the city, and we need some additional detail to be fleshed out before we can go to subcontractors and get bids for all the different components. What we do know is, based on the work, the considerable work that this team has done with marine structures, is that they've figured out a way to have a cost and time-saving method of construction that will ensure the durability of this facility for a long time. And what we know is that this is going to be far less expensive than what's proposed previously for rehabilitation of the natatorium that would basically be an entire reconstruction of the facility.
Brian, as you look at this plan, which you say is much simpler and much easier to construct, is there a sense of how long this would take? Would it be feasible to even think that by 2018, the centenary of the end of World War I that this memorial commemorates, that this would actually be finished?
Well, you know, as a nonprofit group, we're out here encouraging timely and quick action. We have support from all of the groups that we're working with locally for this idea. We've had a lot of positive encouragement, and we want to see this done as quickly as possible. I think that the centennial of World War I does offer a really important opportunity to finally resolve some of these really key issues. If we don't have it fully constructed by the centennial of the armistice, at least we hope to have the plan in place and some consensus around this, because I think that's what we're all looking for.
Well, as today is Veterans Day, once known as Armistice Day, it's a good day to give it some thought. Thank you so much for the time this morning.
Thank you, Beth Ann. It's a pleasure.
Brian Turner is a senior field officer at the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, featuring pianist Sean Kennard and music by Wagner, Liszt, and Sibelius. Ward Stair will conduct this Sunday at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help. Hi, everybody. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. These days, there are many questions being asked about the efficacy of going to college. Is it worth the cost? Will I have a better life than if I don't go? Will it help me secure a job? And there are some that don't even consider higher education. But statistics tell us that attending college for just 1 year will generate 30% more income over a lifetime. And with that 1 year of school, you're 29% less likely to be unemployed. When Jim Lawley and his wife Lynn saw these statistics, they decided to do something about it, and they started the Waialeale Project at Kauai Community College. The program uses high school counselors and social service agencies to identify youths who are not considering college. For those who qualify, the project pays for books, financial aid, tutoring, life skills and study habits, and best of all, it covers tuition. The Waialeale Project is a no-brainer for students on Kauai. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to give us the name and location of Hawaii's National Veterans Cemetery. The Department of Veterans Affairs maintains 135 national cemeteries, but those are located in only 40 states or territories. Hawaii is one of them. Funding to construct a national cemetery in Hawaii was approved by Congress in 1948, and that cemetery was dedicated in 1949. Since then, it has become the resting place for the remains of approximately 53,000 World War I, World War II, Korean War, and Vietnam War veterans and some of their dependents. It has since been added to the National Register of Historic Places, and the on-site memorial is one of the most popular destinations in Hawaii for visitors. The name of that cemetery, of course, is the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, and it's located in Honolulu's Punch Bowl.
And we had lots and lots of callers who knew the punch bowl part. The National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific was a little more difficult, but Christina Swenson knew it and will be receiving the prize. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now 8:49.
Most of us who live here take the privileges of our American citizenship and the very abundance of the country we live in for granted. But for people all over the world, it's a distant dream, the kind of dream that can give purpose to your life. Toto, a new film from the Philippines, being shown at the Hawaii International Film Festival, is the story of a man who lives for the idea of a life in America, even though he has seen the dream's dark side. John Paul Su is the director of Toto, and he's with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me here.
You know, obviously, your film, the world sort of caught up with you in terms of your choice of subject matter, because immigration has become widely discussed and widely kind of reviled in today's world, yeah?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
That's troubling, isn't it?
Very troubling. I myself as an immigrant in America.
Yeah.
I experienced racism when I first came here. Mm-hmm. I moved to New York, and that's even in a progressive city like that.
I'm surprised actually
to
hear that.
I still experience that.
Yeah.
And this is an ode to all the immigrants. This movie's an ode to all immigrants who dreamed of a better life in America, especially for my fellow Filipinos, who is, as you know, the Philippines is the only colony of America
yeah.
and Asia.
That's right.
And that's why a lot of Filipinos still have that dream of coming to America for a better life, for a new life, for a new beginning.
And, you know, we don't use the word colony because we think of ourselves as an anti-colonialist nation, which is pretty much nonsense in the historical
yes.
perspective.
Absolutely.
What else would you call it, right?
Yeah.
When I meet naturalized American citizens, they know more about American history, the Constitution, and they value more about this country than most native-born Americans, in my experience. That's a very subjective thing, but it has really seemed that way to me. Does it to you?
Yeah. Well, first, to be naturalized, you have to study like 100 questions.
Yeah.
And learn about America. And also, I think for an immigrant, you are curious. You're more curious of like the new land where you'll be having your new life.
Mm-hmm.
You want to understand it because you want to adapt. You want to adapt to the new environment, and also assuming that everyone else in America knows the history of America, and you want to be part of that.
You're soon disabused of that, aren't you? Your story is about a young man whose father did immigrate to America, and his life went south in America, and yet the son wants to go there too, right?
Yes. In the Philippines, there's a really strong family values, and I think it's not just in the Philippines, but in Asia, like kids' dreams are usually like dreams that are also the unfulfilled dreams of their parents. So somehow it's the children's obligation or responsibility to fulfill that for the family, and. In this
more
film,
so than in the West, where
yes.
children tend to just completely depart from
yes.
whatever their parents did.
That's why in this film, more than the dream of Toto, the character, it is actually like for him to fulfill the dream of his parents
mm-hmm.
so that his family can also rise up and have a new life.
I don't want to ask you to give a spoiler, but he's... This is the story of a young man who's really, it's become his obsession to come to America.
Yes.
The hurdles he jumps over to do that.
Yeah. On one facet, like the film's about like a Filipino who's obsessed with coming to America and like going through all this journey to get that elusive American U.S. visa.
Yeah.
By the same time, when we crafted this film, the goal was also for immigrants to remind themselves of like how it was when they first set foot in America, the challenges that they go through. I personally, what I went through, people exploiting, new workers, new immigrants,
sure,
being conned. But at the end of the day, like somewhere, somehow, in the perfect time, there's one person who will see the sincerity and your genuine desire to have a new life, to have a better life.
Mm-hmm.
And that person will help you reach your next milestone. And that's been like the reaction from most of the immigrants who have seen the film, and I think I'm very happy with that.
For you, was it worth it?
It was.
Jumping through the hurdles and, you know, getting here?
Yes, I believe so, yeah. Yeah, it opened my mind to, it broadened my perspective of the world. Yeah, because living in the Philippines, you somehow still live in a bubble. You know, we struggle there, but at the same time, we smile to get through with all the challenges. But here, being an alien here, being a new person here, and actually being a minority here, there's more challenges. Like more, you need to adapt more, and also you need to see the politics of like how to get through and build your career.
Ongoing challenge.
It is.
Thank you so much for coming challenge. John Paul Sue is the director of Toto. A feature film will be screened tonight and tomorrow at Honolulu's Dole Cannery Theater as part of the Hawaii International Film Festival's Spotlight on the Philippines. There's also a showing on Kauai on November 20th, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Obviously, this is a day to celebrate veterans, and I'm glad that we were able to talk to our friend Vic Kraft at the start of the show, because he's really advanced some provocative and interesting ideas, yeah.
And those ideas have resurged now and again, but they haven't really been taken up in a way. There's been so much, you know, concern over a draft,
yeah.
You know, but this is not necessarily the same kind of thing.
Right.
Although you're talking about, you know, those who might be called up in the event of a war or conflict where they would be needed, but no different than, say, reservists are. But how this idea of having a year or two that all, you know, young people would give to their country in a lot of different ways. That's not just military service. That's a whole different slant on it. Maybe we should talk about that more.
You know, we've gotten away from the JFK's 1960 ask what you can do for your country. But at that time, that really fired the nation. And it's nice to see that spirit come back.
Well, maybe that needs to be retread.
Yeah.
For us, that's the end of this week. Probably a very difficult week for a lot of people. We'll be back next week and see how we all begin to move into the future together.
We're going to look at a Kauai student production of School of Rock.
We're also going to talk with Vicki Holtakamini about Standing Rock. And we're going to see something happening here, too, about that. More solidarity.
We certainly are. And if you want to hear today's show again, you can get past shows on our conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Koslovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you on Monday with more of The Conversation.